morning? Afternoon?
I think it's maybe like mid-afternoon. Mid-afternoon? I don't know.
Almost. Yeah, it's afternoon. I just checked the clock. We're Crime and Time.
We're Crime and Time on the rocks.
With an up drink.
So this is the Coco Chanel.
I am very excited about the fact that it is, you know, I like Chanel. I'll talk about her. But from what I understand of the ingredients, I'm not super excited about.
Yeah, this is basically just coconut vodka and elderflower liqueur.
It's absolutely beautiful. As I say all the time, it's this like iridescent, completely clear gorgeousness. And we have them in these beautiful glasses.
Yeah, so these glasses actually are Grey Goose martini glasses that came promotionally with like a bottle of Grey Goose, but they're really pretty.
They're incredibly elegant and very pretty. It's a very high, steep, narrow martini bowl.
And they are full to the rim, so I'm not going to pick mine up to try my drink.
No, I'm going to slurp.
All right. I'm going to try it.
Okay. The kitten belly needs to move so I can try it.
Nope. That's a nope for me.
Guess what my vote is?
That's a no. I don't like.
Oh, I think it just went down the wrong pipe. That was horrifying. I'm going to try one more time without choking myself. It tastes like suntan lotion.
It does taste like suntan lotion. Okay, so we had to do a slight pause for your reaction, which turns out you hate it, but you also swallowed it the wrong way.
I swallowed it the wrong way, and so it like seared the inside of my throat. But it's not good. It's suntan lotion. It reminds me of 1989 laying out in the backyard, slathered in as much coconut oil as I could possibly put on my
body. With some sun in your hair?
With some sun in my hair. And the sprinkler going to keep reasonably cool because we live in 100 and stupid hot weather.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. Love the look.
So I don't care for it either, but I'll slowly, slowly sip it as we tell the story because I realized that the less you have in your mouth at one time, the better it tastes.
Yes. I might take a sip here and there, but yeah.
All right. You want me to go first? You want to go first?
Yeah, you go first.
All right. I'm going to start with a quote. It'll come up again in the story, but this is how I got my nexus to Coco Chanel. There's a quote in my story that says, I said, if you're Gianni Versace, then I'm Coco Chanel.
Ooh.
So I'm going to tell you about Andrew Cunanan.
Okay.
So Andrew Philip Cunanan was born in 1969. He grew up in San Diego, that vicinity. As a teenager, he was known to be a prolific liar. He was known for telling all these outrageous stories.
Now he makes noise.
Cat's upset.
Child number two was trying to get him to purr on the microphone and he wouldn't do it. Now he's screaming.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, he was known to tell tall tales about his family and his personal life, and he would like change his appearance all the time also. Like completely change his appearance. Mm-hmm. In high school, he came out as gay, and after that, or like, you know,
in the 60s?
He was born in 69. Okay. So high school would have been like 80s. Yeah.
Still brave.
Yeah. And he began having liaisons with these wealthy older men. In 1987, he graduated from high school and he was voted least likely to be forgotten, which might actually like be true. I don't know what, you know,
least likely to be forgotten. That's an
like most memorable, I guess.
Yeah.
Except for not now, but later.
That is an interesting way of putting that.
Yeah.
Because it's not most likely to succeed.
It's not. It could be derogatory, or it could be like, you're so awesome, everyone's going to know who you are.
Right.
You're going to be president, or you're going
to... Which is a completely late 80s thing to do, say, etc.
Mm-hmm.
That could have been in my yearbook easily.
Yeah. I don't remember all of ours, but that could have been one of them.
My girlfriend and I, a couple of days after graduation, took our senior yearbook and we went through, and for every single person we made a what will they be doing in 10 years, and then at our 25th reunion I found it and we read it to each other and it was really funny.
Oh my gosh.
And some of them were mean, but
so yeah, he enrolled in UC San Diego after that, and
nice.
He majored in American history.
Cool.
And then he, you know, did that for a little bit, dropped out of college, and he moved to San Francisco. So that was where, in 1990, Andrew Cunanan first met fashion designer Gianni Versace.
Oh, I know what story this is.
So Versace was in town doing fittings for the costumes that he had designed for the San Francisco Opera. Cunanan was with his friend, Eric Greenwald, just after meeting Versace, and he... Andrew, who was known for embellishing, told the story, like, as he always does, embellishes, and he tells Greenwald that he said, "I said if you're Gianni Versace, then I'm Coco Chanel."
Yeah, because that's what you'd say when you meet a famous person.
Yeah. So Cunanan, after that, began dating this wealthy older man named Norman Blanchard. Blanchard was financially supporting him.
Yeah.
So...
Did he graduate college? I don't remember.
No, he dropped out. So in 1996, they broke up, and Cunanan...
Oh, wow, they dated a long time.
Yeah, well, like, yeah, I think like 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
So they broke up. Cunanan had maxed out all his credit cards.
Oh, my gosh.
So...
His that the wealthy person provided for him, or the wealthy person's?
His that the wealthy person provided for him.
Got it.
And then, you know, of course, they break up. He gets cut off from that.
Yeah.
So he turns to selling drugs. And he's also using drugs.
Of course. Don't get high on your own supply.
Yeah. He didn't take that to heart.
No, apparently not.
So he has this friend, Jeff Trail, who lives in Minneapolis. And in April 1997, Cunanan tells his friends that he was going to leave San Diego and go to Minneapolis to, quote, take care of some business matters. With Trail.
Okay. It'd be much cheaper to live in Minneapolis than San Diego.
Especially, yeah, in 1997. So before Cunanan's visit, Jeff Trail told his sister that he did not want Andrew to come. So he's there. It's April 27th at this point. They have an argument. So Cunanan kills Jeff Trail.
What?
Yeah. So Trail had been beaten to death with a claw hammer, and he... Like, his body was rolled up in a rug. And that when they found him, his watch had been stopped at 9:55 p.m., which the investigators believed was the time of the killing.
That is a horrific way to murder someone.
Yeah.
You're angry.
And then, so they found out the murder happened at one of Cunanan's ex-boyfriend's houses in Minneapolis, whose name was David Mattson. So
was the body found there? Or they rolled it up and moved it.
They rolled it up and moved it. Or actually, I don't have that. Wait, maybe I do. No. Okay, no, this isn't the one that they moved. This was at the apartment. So Mattson, as you might guess, became the second victim.
Oh my gosh.
So this is
not where I saw it going.
No, but this is the weird part. So April 29th, a bunch of witnesses, because he lived in an apartment building, they saw Cunanan and Mattson walking Mattson's dog, which was 2 days after Trail had been killed. So at first, the police thought Mattson was a suspect. But Madsen's family members were like, no, 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 he would never do that. He was being held captive by Cunanan.
But he's walking his dog.
2 days after Trail's murder.
Right.
Yeah.
So how is he being held captive if they're out walking the dog?
Yeah, that's the weird part. So, anyway, whether he was... being held captive or not, he became the next victim because they found Madsen's body on May 3rd. He was on the east shore of a lake. He had gunshot wounds to the head and back. And Mattson's family believes that he had walked in on the murder of Trail and then was probably just going along with whatever Cunanan wanted him to go along with to not get killed.
Right. That... plausible.
That
I guess.
Is plausible. Like, if he walked in and said, oh yeah, you know, I wouldn't hold that against you, he deserved it, you know, mm-hmm. blah, blah,
just
blah.
To stay alive.
Just to stay alive.
But what did they do with his body for 2 days? Did it just sit there chilling?
I don't know. I didn't look that far into that one.
Mm. This may not be the story I'm thinking of.
It might be. It is. There's just a lot to it. So Cunanan left Minneapolis, and he drove to Chicago, and he killed this other man, 72-year-old Lee Miglin. Miglin was found dead in his garage. He had been stabbed more than 20 times with a screwdriver.
Oh my gosh.
That's not the worst part. And his throat had been cut open with a hacksaw.
I'm making a face.
Yeah.
Hacksaw is a very small tool to cut someone's throat with.
I know. And like, clearly that wasn't premeditated like his other... Well, I mean, it wasn't the same kind of premeditated like his other ones, because he didn't go in with a shotgun.
No, he grabbed what was there.
In a garage.
Oh my gosh. A hacksaw is what you use to like cut twigs for kindling.
Yeah. Oh, so his wife, Miglin's wife, was supposed to be picked up at the airport by him, and then when he didn't show up, she got concerned, couldn't reach him, and then called the police, and that's when they found that he had been killed.
So was this a case of he's practicing his secret life while his wife is out of town?
They don't know that. The family, of course, is saying that he had never met Cunanan, but the investigators can't say that for sure, because there was no sign of forced entry or anything like that that would lead it to be like a stranger kind of thing.
He was probably asking for money or something, and the old man said no.
But the thing I'm thinking, though, is if you're in your garage working, a lot of people do that with the garage door open. So he could have seen the open garage door, went up to him and said, I want money, or I want this, or I want that. So, I mean, it's plausible that they actually did never know each other.
That is very, very true.
After Miglin was murdered, the FBI placed Cunanan on the FBI's most wanted list. He was the 449th fugitive on the list.
That's a number.
Yes. On May 9th, Cunanan committed his fourth murder. So this was...
He's just on a spree.
He's on a spree, yeah. William Reese was a caretaker at a cemetery in New Jersey, and they found him dead in the cemetery office. This time, he had been shot in the head, and his pickup truck was gone. So they found... The reason why they linked this to Cunanan is because they found a green Lexus with Illinois plates in the spot where the truck had been, and it was the Lexus that he had stolen from Miglin's garage. Ah. So that was easy to put one and one together.
Yeah.
So it was later determined that Cunanan most likely just killed Reese for the truck and not for any other motive. Like, they definitely didn't know each other.
Yeah.
So after the New Jersey murder, it became clear that Cunanan was just willing to go anywhere, move around the country. So, like, all these gay groups around the country were concerned that he would try to, I don't want to say infiltrate, because he also was a gay person, but like he would try to insinuate himself into their groups and then have more victims, basically.
Right. Or try to hide within it.
Or hide within it, yeah. The New York City Gay and Lesbian Anti-Violence Project, they put up a huge reward, and they started like just sending out warnings to all the people they might know that could come into contact with him.
Don't be friendly to this person.
Yeah.
He'll murder you.
But one of the interesting things is, like, as I mentioned before, he was so good at changing his appearance.
So it was hard to see who he was.
Yeah, so even if you look now on, like, the FBI website or, like, different publications, they have all these different pictures, and they don't all resemble each other. Like, it's not clear that this is all the same man.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's interesting.
So they did an episode of America's Most Wanted. And this is when he was added to the top 10 most wanted.
Oh, he moved up?
Yeah, he moved up. They established the telephone tip line, which America's Most Wanted did regularly anyway. Mm-hmm.
That program solved a lot of crime.
It was looking at some very prominent cases that it helped solve. Like, that's awesome. Gianni Versace. Gianni Versace, as you know, is like a famous fashion designer.
Yes.
He was living in a mansion in the South Beach area of Miami. And on July 15th, he had been on a walk, and he was coming back to his house when Andrew Cunanan approached him and shot him on the steps of the house.
For any good reason, or just, hey, I'm already going out. I'm going to go out
go out big. That's kind of what I think. He knew of Gianni Versace. They'd met before, supposedly.
Yeah.
And he was like...
Which means they could have just been in the same room together.
Yeah. Which is probably what it was.
Yeah. That is so crazy that you can, at any time, be in a room with someone who has done or will do horrific things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Cunanan, they found out later, had been living in Miami for 2 months before he killed Versace.
So he cooled it. He didn't... Well, we don't know that he didn't murder anyone, but it's unlikely because they would have found out.
So back to the day of the attack, Cunanan fled on foot, and then when the police got there, they found William Reese's truck in a nearby parking garage. So that's how they linked
it to him.
Yeah. And then in the truck, they found clothes that were belonging to Andrew Cunanan, and they found a fake passport, and they found a bunch of newspaper clippings about all the murders that he had done.
So he's collecting his own trophies.
Yeah.
Ew.
Yeah, he's like that guy.
Yeah. I've met that guy. I mean, not that guy, but...
Yeah.
You know.
So even though he was on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list, he didn't really make... It's not like he was trying to hide out. He... used his own name at a pawn shop. Like,
really?
He was, yeah, oftentimes he would go out in the afternoons and evenings. He was pretty visible. He didn't, like, just stay and hide out.
After he shot a world-famous fashion designer. And they knew who he was. Wasn't his face plastered everywhere?
Yeah.
And so he felt confident enough in his ability to change the appearance.
Yeah, he was kind of like the chameleon. Like, he just would... changed some, like, he had been doing it his whole life, basically. Let's see. So Versace's memorial service was on July 22nd, 1997. It was in Milan. And on July 23rd, 1997, Andrew Cunanan committed suicide. So after Versace was killed, they started this, like, whole, like, nationwide search to find Cunanan.
Uh-huh.
Over 1,000 FBI agents took part in this manhunt, and it basically commenced on July 23rd, which was the day Cunanan killed himself, because he was hiding out in a houseboat that he had broken into, and the police were closing in on him, and he ended up shooting himself in the mouth using the same gun that he used to kill Mattson, Reese, and Versace. He didn't leave a note or leave any explanation of his crimes. But there are reports, including one that was in the New York Times, that says that Cunanan had told some friends that he was HIV positive and he was murdering former lovers. Basically as vengeance for whoever had infected him. But
yeah,
when they did an autopsy, he was HIV negative.
Yeah. And I don't think that he was with Versace.
No. And to the cemetery guy and... Miglin and...
The guy who stole the truck, is that Miglin?
Yeah, they were never lovers.
No.
That we know of.
Yeah.
So anyway, this was from Harper's Bazaar, Wikipedia, and FBI.gov.
Oh my goodness. Interesting. So I did... You know, we're drinking the Coco Chanel. I'm going to talk about Coco Chanel. She is fascinating, and I can't decide if I like her or not.
I did a little digging into her when I was trying to find a story.
Uh-huh.
And she is fascinating, like you said. I didn't do a deep dive at all. I was just looking for an angle, like maybe someone she knew was maybe a criminal, which is plausible and probable, but I couldn't find a lot on any of those people. So, right.
Well, and we'll get into it as I go through her life, but she's very much a survivor. She is, you know, she was dealt... raw cards, and she did well with them, and she said what she needed to say to survive. But one of the things that she did to survive, I'm not super sure. Not that it's not forgivable, because, you know, most things can be, but this was not good. It was bad.
It just leaves like a bad taste in your mouth.
Yes, because besides that, she was great. But so my sources really quickly: Coco Chanel quotes, fashion and facts, biography. Gabrielle Chanel, the founder of Chanel, Coco Chanel biography, childhood, life, achievement, and timeline from The Famous People, the history of Coco Chanel, early life Coco Chanel from Weebly, and Coco Chanel's Secret Life, and this is going to give it away, as a Nazi agent.
I think I looked at that one when I was looking for stories.
Yeah. So let's just tell her story first, but I'm going to... So women must tell men always that they are the strong ones. They are the big, the strong, and the wonderful. In truth, women are the strong ones. It's just my opinion. I'm not a professor. I thought that was a cute quote from her. So Coco Chanel was born Gabrielle Bonheur Chanel, I'm assuming, on August 19th, 1883 in Saumur, France. She really, really had a rough go at the beginning, and it was in a stark contrast to her glamorous life later. Her parents were never married. They had multiple children. Her father was a traveling peddler, and he worked selling ladies' clothes, work clothes, and undergarments. And her mother was a laundress. So her mother died very young. Her mother was only 32. She died from bronchitis. Gabrielle was only 12, and so dad took all of his children and just, well, he took the girls to the orphanage, and he just left the boys.
That happened in another story we talked about, too. I think, I can't remember who it was on, but they took, it might have been one that I told.
Uh-huh.
The girls went to the orphanage, the boys just got left.
Yeah, just bye. So the three girls go off to the orphanage, and he runs off, and she literally never sees him again. She says her entire life that he ran off to America to seek his fortune, but she honestly has no idea. And this was a common theme in her life. She stretches the truth to fit the narrative that she wants it to fit.
It's her coping mechanism.
It's her coping. Totally. Yes. So for the next 7 years, she's raised by the nuns at the Abbey of Aberzine. They taught her how to sew, though. So, oh. You know, that's a
sew.
She took a lot of inspiration from her life in the Abbey, her style, her color palette. I watched this thing. They had all these little movies at the Chanel website. And one of them was The Colors of Chanel. And the majority of her work was done in black, white, off-white, gold, burgundy, or red, and pink.
Yeah.
Those are like her colors.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so she took a lot of inspiration from the colors, a lot of the decoration. They even speculation that her intertwining C's came from one of the stained glass windows. So as, you know, she can only stay in the orphanage till she's 18. So when she's 18, she started in another profession to get by and make ends meet. And she is singing in a cabaret frequented by cavalry officers, who she gets a lot of her inspiration from military uniforms.
Oh, from
too.
Their uniforms.
Yes,
yeah.
I will mention this multiple times. So she's singing, and they think that this is where her nickname of Coco came from, because she would sing these songs that referred to Coco in some way. What were some of the names? Who Has Seen Coco? There were a couple other songs that had Coco. And these are French songs, and the term Coco in these songs refers to a shortened version of the word coquette, which means a kept woman. But there's no evidence that she was ever officially a coquette herself.
I could see that, though. She's singing all the songs, and then maybe, like, the audience and stuff would call her, hey, Coco.
Coco, yeah. However, of course, when asked about where she got her nickname later in life, oh, my father gave it to me when I was young. Well,
that's just a typical your father, that's like, you know, daddy issues kind of thing.
Yes, totally. So she does well. She, you know, gets on with things. At the age of 20, she becomes involved with a young man named Etienne Balsan, who he not only is involved with her romantically, but he gives her some money to help start a business. She was at that time making hats. She didn't like the way, she was very practical. She didn't like the way women's hats had all of this stuff on them. She just wanted a hat that would keep the sun off your neck. So she was going to sell simple, elegant hats. So he sets her up with money to do that. Meanwhile, he's teaching her different things. He's showing her different things. He introduces her to this and that, and he introduces her to horses.
Oh.
Where she absolutely refuses to ride side saddle. That's just not safe. I'm not going to do it. So she rides astride.
She's not wrong.
No, she's totally not. And this is when she starts developing her own unique style of dress, because she wants to go and play with Etienne and do all these fun things that he's doing, playing football on the beach and riding horses and whatnot. And she wants to be involved in that, and you can't do that if you're in the stuffy corset with the big hat with all the flowers on it of the, you know, 1890s. So she starts developing her own clothing because she thinks it's too restrictive. And her taste was inspired by the masculine, but it was still feminine. And all of the other girls that are sitting there in their horrible corsets and big hats are looking at her going, well, that looks comfortable.
I would like to wear that.
Yes. So she is seeing this pattern that people are noticing her clothes. So soon, her and Etienne's romance fades, and she gets involved with one of her, and I didn't like the way multiple sources said this. They said she soon leaves Etienne for one of his wealthier friends, Arthur Boy Chappelle. I don't know that that was the case, but her and Boy, he was the love of her life. He also helped her. He was a wealthy Englishman. They were not able to, I think if she were to marry, she would have married Boy, but, and I'm speculating here, of course, but his status would not allow that. And he had to eventually, quote, disconnect from Gabrielle to get married.
Oh, that's sad.
But something else happens. So anyway, he also invests in her business and helps her. He actually helps her with her hat shop in 1910. And he also helps her open a boutique in Deauville in 1912. However, lest you think that she was a coquette, she paid him back every single penny that he lent her within the first year of opening her private couture house.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So she did it herself. She was financially backed by him, but she paid him back. And so during the same time that she brings in her sister to help because they're so busy. And during this time where she's running around with Boy, they're going on vacations. They're going to beaches in Venice and here and there and Lido and all these different places. And she likes to lay out and get tan. She's like, I don't want to be in this stuffy dress where I could drown. I want to be, you know, comfortable. So she starts just, again, going with her own fashion so that she can go golfing and skiing and yachting and fishing and all of those fun things. So she's basically wearing sportswear before it was sportswear. She says, so she'd had this one incident where she, maybe I'll talk about that in a minute. Oh yeah. So she said, quote, I invented the sports dress for myself, not because other women played sports, but because I did. And I didn't go out because I needed to design dresses. I designed dresses precisely, whoa, my thing went wonky. Precisely because I wanted to go out, but where is my, because I wanted to go out, because I lived for myself the life of the century. Her hat store was called Chanel Modes. They were worn by fancy, they were first worn by ladies of the night, but then they started to be worn by the fancy people. And 2 years later is when she sets up her second boutique in Deauville. That's the one where she had the couture shop and she paid Boy back. Her very first taste of clothing was between those two. She was out with Boy and she got cold. And so someone gave her a jersey and she fixed it and fashioned it so that it looked cute. And people liked it. And they literally stopped her and asked her, where did you get that dress? And she's like, I made it. The quote on this is, my fortune is built on that old jersey that I put on because it was cold in Deauville.
There's such a fine line though between her like looking like she's a crazy person. Yes. Versus looking like she's fashion forward.
Right. And I think some of that line was the fact that she was there with a Boy Chappelle versus some soldier that she, you know, met.
Yeah.
Because she could have very easily gone that direction.
I'm just thinking about, like, you know, you see people that are just doing their own thing fashion-wise, mm-hmm. and sometimes you're like, they're a crazy person. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're like, oh, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And not that she was not talented. She was amazing. She had a beautiful eye. But
clearly,
some of it has to be luck because you picked Etienne instead of the soldier.
Yeah.
You know, and singing in a club, she probably had opportunity to go either way.
Oh, for sure. Because who went to the clubs? The soldiers.
Yes. So anyway, so she's built her thing on the, from 1913, she began to sell this line of sportswear made from jersey, which was a material that was not typically used for clothing. It was mostly used for men's underwear. In 1916, so she's moving up fast, Roeder, who's a French textile industrialist, gave exclusive use of his jersey fabric to Gabrielle Chanel. And she started designing with this fabric and did well. She took over 31 Rue Cambon in 1918. I'm assuming I'm saying that correct. The 31
I'm
building...
assuming you're not, because you normally don't say anything correct.
Lovely. So she takes the 31 building, housed a boutique with the salons and workshops, and she still, her company, still occupies that building today, 31 Rue Cambon.
You can get me back on pronunciations when we get to the Macedonian pronunciations that I have later.
Okay.
Like, in the next episode group.
So she has this building, and she's designing these clothes. Her skirts are getting shorter. She's not corseting the waist. Now, keeping in mind, this is 1918, so think about the fashions that are coming up in the next couple of years.
Yes.
Shorter skirts, non-corseted waists, light flowing fabric. She brought in, I don't want to say the flapper look, but she brought in the 20th century look that shifted from that stuffy dress with the corset and the
it makes you wonder bustle. How quickly we would have arrived at that without her, like, right. I don't know, it's just an interesting thought.
Yes. She wanted to revolutionize women's relationships with their bodies. She was an instant success, and she, by 1915, she was employing 300 workers. So the next year, her couture house is taking off. Her and boy, quotes, separate for him to marry, but they're still really together. However, that same year, which is 1916, I believe, he was killed in an automobile accident.
Aww.
Devastated her. So she went to Venice with her friend Misa Sert and her husband, and we need to find a cocktail that will go with Misa, because she has a fascinating life. Just, I like dipped my toe in her pool, and fascinating life. She was like a muse to all of these fancy artists. So she's got these contacts, and she's connecting Chanel with all of these fancy artists. Chanel actually did some costumes for several ballets and plays based on connections that she made through Misa.
Oh, that's a good connection.
Oh, yes. And she was also friends with just this little guy you may have heard of, Picasso.
Probably don't know him.
Yeah. So, anyway, she, when boy died, the first and last time she was ever seen in public crying. Going around Venice, she absolutely falls in love with the symbol of the lion and the Byzantine style of many of the buildings. So she's got this Baroque style from her childhood, along with the Byzantine style, and then the lions. And she decorates with lions everywhere, in her jewelry, in her house, everywhere there's lions, because she just loved it. Misa was from Russia, and she was quite the personality herself. She, like I said, she was a model, a muse, she was a pianist, and she had all these fabulous friends. Well, one of her friends was with a Ernest Beau. Well, one of her friends was the Grand Duke Dimitri, and Chanel has a torrid affair with the Grand Duke Dimitri, who is 8 years younger than her. But before Dimitri, after boy, she had a brief affair with Stravinsky.
Oh.
Igor Stravinsky.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't think I could date someone named Igor.
He is the person who wrote The Rite of Spring, and she actually helped with finance one of the later productions of the piece. She had gone to see it in 1913, the original production of it, and Rite of Spring is the piece of music that is behind the dinosaur scene in Fantasia.
It's been so long since I've seen Fantasia, I'd have to...
It's not the typical ballet that people were used to seeing. I just taught this in my last unit of my history class.
I'm going to have to go back and look at that.
It's very... it's got a lot of odd sounds and booms.
Such as when dinosaurs are doing ballet.
Yes, when dinosaurs are doing ballet. But so she had the affair with Igor Stravinsky. Now she's having an affair with the Grand Duke Dimitri, who was an exile from the imperial family of Russia. So as she's hanging out with Grand Duke Dimitri, she meets Ernest Beau, who was the perfumer of the Tsars. So can you imagine having the whole Tsar? We have to do more in the Russians, because the Tsars had their own perfumer.
All right, people, send us some more Russian drinks.
Yeah,
we need Russian drinks. I've liked all the Russian drinks we've done anyway.
Yes. Yes, they have been very, very good. And the story's been fascinating. So I want to do some more research into the Imperial family. But so they had their own perfumer.
So I did read a little bit about, like, they had, like, a facsimile, basically, of Chanel No. 5, but it was only popular in Russia.
Oh, interesting.
And it never, like, made its way outside of Russia, but it was, like, it
a used... faux Chanel No. 5?
I don't know if it was faux or if it just coincidentally, like, had
was
a
lot... close to it?
Yeah, but it was very comparable, but it didn't use any, like, it used so many different ingredients. Like, it was... not the same at all. Uh-huh. Like, you couldn't say it was the same, but it was the Chanel No. 5 of Russia.
Oh, interesting. Well, that was one of the things that Chanel No. 5 was known for, was that it was not... typically, prior to that time, perfume had been eau de rose, lavender, whatever. It was a flower.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he combined all of these flowers so that it smelled like flowers, but not a flower. She wanted the woman to smell like a woman, not a flower. So that was her design with the her idea with the perfume.
She's definitely a progressive, very progressive
for
woman.
Sure. However, this whole deal is just a raw deal. She was not using her head when she did this. So it's developed by Beau, and where's his name? Ernest Beau. And but it's done in partnership with. Oh, so here's another quote about her perfume. She says, perfume is the unseen, unforgettable, ultimate accessory of fashion that heralds your arrival and prolongs your departure.
True.
It does. I have worn the same perfume for nearly 30 years, and I love it. And my grandmother did as well. She wore, we both wear the same brand, but we wore different ones. She wore, I want to say white linen, and I wear pleasures. But I can still smell, when I smell white linen, that's my grandma.
Yeah.
And so my girls have said the same thing about pleasures. They're like, well, that's mom. That's me. So anyway, so that's what she said about her perfume. However, in this deal, so she's, well, first the name. So the name comes from, this was the fifth formula that he showed her. And she said, they were asking her, what should you name it? So she says, to the question, what should I name it? She answered, I'm presenting my collection of five dresses on May 5th, on the fifth month of the year. Therefore, I will give it the number that it is wearing, and the number five will bring it luck. Because she was presented
to
her number five. Yes, since it's still around and very popular. So now the fragrance was backed by department store owner Theophile Bedard and businessmen Pierre and Paul Werthmeyer, and Chanel, because Chanel had a very close friendship with Pierre. The deal that was eventually struck, the Werthmeyers would take 70%.
Oh, wow. She got shafted.
Oh, it's not. It's worse. Of the profits and for producing the perfume in their factories, Bedard received 20%.
So that's 90.
Yes, leaving Chanel with 10. So 5 has been a massive hit. It is still sold very, very well today. She tried to sue multiple times to get more rights, and she was never successful. She even tried to renegotiate during World War II, given that the Werthmeyers were Jewish. She thought she had a chance because the Jewish people in Europe were forced to forfeit their businesses at the time.
Wow.
And prior to, they were not dumb, because prior to this, they signed everything over to a Frenchman, a non-Jewish Frenchman who was named Felix Amont. And then the Werthmeyers went to the United States. So now the company is not owned by Jewish people, so Hitler can't touch it. So she still lost her suit and was still only given 10% of the profits of this perfume. She made enough money. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's fine.
But around 1923, she meets another man. She meets wealthy Hugh Grosvenor, don't know. He was the Duke of Westminster, so I'm just going to call him Westminster. He was the richest man in England. No big deal. She meets him aboard his yacht, and they started a 2-decade-long relationship. He absolutely showered her in luxury and gifts, but when he asked her to marry him, she said, she reportedly said, there have been several duchesses of Winchester, but there's only one Chanel.
Oh, yes. She's like, I'm not giving up my independence.
Yes, and that's exactly what it was. She was not going to give anything up for a man. She could do as long as she was not married, because at that time, if you got married, you lost a lot.
All of it, basically.
And she could do what she wanted. So the Société de Parfum Chanel company was created in 1924 to produce and sell more perfumes and cosmetics. Ernest Beau became the house's first in-house perfume designer. And his first collections of powders and lipsticks were created that same year. In 1925 is when she created the famous suit with the collarless jacket and the well-fitted skirt. Her designs were absolutely revolutionary for the time. She borrowed from menswear and emphasized the comforts and constraints of the popular fashion, and she helped women say goodbye to the corsets and other confining garments. One of the things that I found out about, I have a couple of sweaters that look similar to the suit, and I just love them. But one of the things that I found out, in the lining of the suit, along the hem, she sews little, well, she doesn't, but they sew little gold chains. And that's to help the suit hang properly.
Oh, okay, that's smart.
So it doesn't curl up at the corners, it just hangs.
That's smart.
With the weight of this little gold chain, yeah. So in 1927, she launched the first beauty products with a complete range of 15 skincare products and a reflection of Mademoiselle, which is what she was called at this time, Chanel's innovative vision. In September of 1928, I don't know what he's doing, but he's making all kinds of noise.
Kitty's making noise.
In September of 1928, she purchased land in Robinique Cap Martin between Menton and Monaco. And there she built her villa, the La Posa. And she has fabulous friends and fabulous parties there, like the Duke of Westminster, who she's sleeping with, Jean Cateau, Pierre Revendery, and the Hugo family, and Gala, and Salvador Dali.
Oh, just yeah. Salvador Dali.
Just a few people here and there. Just coming down for a party. It's no big deal. Another 1920 revolutionary design was her little back dress. Black was not a color that was worn then. It was strictly reserved for mourning. And she said, I'm going to make black chic.
And she did.
Totally made black chic. Like, still, that is what you wear now, the little black dress. Yeah. I've had several of them. Not Chanel black dresses, but I've had several little black dresses.
Oh, that's just a staple for every woman.
It is. You have to have one. I probably have one in my closet right now. So she designed that in the 20s. She became a popular figure with the literary set in Paris. She designed costumes for ballets and operas and all kinds of things. About this time, a little guy here in America, Samuel Goldwyn, takes notice. And he says, I want Chanel to come to Hollywood. So in 1931, he asked her to come to Hollywood and design, dress the stars. Because at that time, that was the time of the contract players.
Yeah.
So all of the stars, everything they did was work, because they had to, you have to go out and go to this party, you have to go here and blah, blah, blah.
And they were provided their costumes.
Correct. So Goldwyn wanted her to come, and she arrives to the U.S. on the Europa. She lands in Ellis Island. She has a little bit of luggage, no big deal. She brings Misla, her friend, two assistants, three maids, two models, 15 trunks, and 35 pieces of luggage.
What?
She's just staying for a few days.
Just a light trip.
So then she travels across the country by train. She is met at the train station by starlet Greta Garbo. And the newspaper headline for the day said, two queens meet. While there, she designed costumes for Tonight or Never, 1931. And the Greeks had a word for them in 1932. Most of America loves her work. Or most of the wealthy Americans loved her work. The stars loved her work. But the average, everyday citizen really didn't. They thought she was too simple and clean. They wanted
more flashy.
I can
see that. Because they expect fancy to be fancy, not fancy to be simple.
Right. So they didn't want to see the stars in that. They wanted to see the stars glitter and glitz. So rather than cowing to the pressure and designing glitter and glitz, she just says, all right, bye. And
she went back to Paris. Going back to Paris.
She goes back to the mansion, and in her mansion, she opens her jewelry line, which was a collection of high jewelry that was mixed with costumes. So you might have a beautiful diamond studded around rhinestones, and that was not done. Jewelry up until that point was here's your costume jewelry that you wear, and here's your real stuff that you might wear a little bit, but mostly you just kept it put away. She had more than 45 jewelry pieces that were presented, and it sparked scandal all over the fine jewelry world because, you know, you can't.
Because they were like, oh, crap, nobody's going to want our stuff now.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, because you want the nicer, the prettier stuff, but it's a design. It's not a jewel. Mm-hmm. It's a design. She had this one necklace that I had seen, but I didn't realize it was hers. And it's a band necklace that goes around your neck. I'm not sure how it goes on because I didn't see a clasp, but it's not connected. So
your
chest would be the star, and then it's like the tail of the star going around your neck.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Star would be the real stone, and then the rest would be the rhinestones. Around the same time is when she introduces the bag. It was called 2.55 for the date that it was released. It is a classic black quilted bag. The original one was made of lambskin, and it had a burgundy silk lining. The gold chain had a leather strap going through it that you can adjust to make it two straps or one strap. And you can hear that classic ripple.
Yes.
When the chain goes through the little gold rivets. So she got this idea. Prior to that time, women had carried their bags. Everything was a clutch. So, because you've seen all the pictures of the people in the 20s with their clutch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she thought, I want to be able to use my hands. I don't want to carry my purse. Always practical. I want to be able to use my hands and pick up a drink or pick up food or whatever. So she noticed that the soldiers were carrying these great big huge duffel bags with this little thin strap slung over their shoulder. Why can't women do that?
They can.
Yes. So she designed this bag with this little thin strap with the leather through it, the chain with the leather through it. And women, of course, loved it. They thought it was fabulous. So bag took off. I looked it up, and they still offered in black. I've seen it in white. And then I was starting to notice on TV, it's one of the most knocked off bags. So I don't know that this one was a knockoff, but I was watching one of those silly housewife shows, and this woman had one that was black, but it looked like it had been dusted with silver glitter. And I can't imagine that you would buy a silver glitter Chanel bag. That just seems excessive.
That does seem excessive, because that's like contrary to the whole style.
Right. Yes, exactly. But they're gorgeous. They're also very pricey. In 1936, just like the rest of the world, she faced a strike. She had more than 4,000 workers go on strike, but atypical of Chanel, she gives into their demands to get them back to work. Let's get back to work. Because she did not necessarily slow down during the Depression.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yes.
In 1937, she included herself in an advertising campaign, not done before her. She's the first one to do it. And so while she didn't slow down during the Depression, she did slow down during World War II. She fired all of her workers. She shut down all of her shops except for Rue 31. And there's all kinds of pictures all over the internet of the soldiers that were stationed in Paris lined up in front of Rue 31 to buy their sweethearts number 5.
Aw, that's so cute.
It's so adorable because they're like posing for the pictures and they're, you know.
And they're open.
Yeah, and they're open. Yay, we can get it. However, this is where you might go.
The questionable side of the story.
Yes, the questionable part. So the Nazis come in and take over Paris in 1940, and part of this could have been because she was an orphan. She did what she needed to do to survive, and that was just ingrained in her. So, well, these people are taking over. I got to survive. Hi, Baron Hans Gunther von Dinklage. I'm going to be your girlfriend now. He was an officer in the Abwehr, which is German military intelligence. And this romance allowed her to remain in her comfortable living quarters in the Hotel Ritz, because it was doubling as a German headquarters. And also helped her remain firmly entrenched in Parisian high society, because Parisian high society at the time was firmly entrenched in the Nazis. So, you know. Do with it what you will. She did have some important things that she needed to take care of. Her nephew, André Palsson, was imprisoned in a German Stalag in 1940, and this relationship actually helped her get him released. The story is that Dinklage introduced her to Abwinar, to a prominent Abwinar agent, Baron Louis de Valferland, who said he would set her nephew free if she would do some service to for Berlin. Now, she did, in 1941, she did register as an agent. F7124 was her code, and her code name was Westminster. And they told her that she needed to take this political information to Madrid. She did travel to Madrid during this time in 1941 with her lover, and under the guise of a business trip. There is a record of her having dinner with the British diplomat Brian Wallace, but it is said that she just discussed life in occupied Paris and the animosity between the French and the Germans. There's no evidence that there was anything past, and nothing really came from any information that she would have been privy to anyway, but nonetheless, they released her nephew.
I guess that was worth it.
Yeah, don't know. Sometime between 43 and 44, the tide starts turning against Germany, and they ask her to do another mission. She was asked to do another mission by General Walter Schallenberg of the SS, and it was named Operation Model Hut, German for model hat. She was to use her personal connections to Churchill, who she was great pals with, to relay word that the SS senior officers might want to stop fighting.
So that one I did look into, because I was like, well, maybe I can just do that, make that my whole story, but I couldn't find enough on it.
And that's all I found out.
Yeah.
Was literally that.
I like did a deep dive trying to like Google and like go on like German and then Google Translate and everything. I couldn't find anything.
She did arrange for the release of another one of her friends, Vera Lombardi, who was a mutual friend of both hers and Churchill's. That person was in an Italian prison. And at the time, she traveled to Madrid with Dinklage, and Lombardi was instructed to give a letter from her to Churchill at the British Embassy. But when Lombardi got there, he completely denounced Chanel and her associates and said, they're all German spies, they're bad people. He's immediately taken back into custody, and she is returned to Paris.
Wah, wah.
Yes. In August 1944, a few months after her trip, the French forces reclaimed Paris, and she had a reputation as a, quote, horizontal collaborator. She was taken in for questioning before the Free French Purge Committee. But she was released and went to Switzerland. She was in Switzerland for sort of an exile, but she also visited her country house in Robinique for a time. But by the end of the war, she had to appear in French court, but to account her in her sworn testimony from the German officers and all of that big thing. But she doesn't end up in any trouble. She claimed, you know, she says, I was just trying to get my nephew out of prison. I did what they said so that I could get my nephew out of prison. And there's speculation that her good old pal Churchill may have
pulled some strings.
So she was never charged, but her public opinion suffered a little bit. And I found a lot of websites that were like, don't buy Chanel, do you know what she did?
I saw similar ones.
Yeah. So she, of course, remake herself, rechange things. So she gets word that Schallenberg was planning on publishing his memoir. So he's very, very sick. And so she pays all of his medical bills and pays for his funeral. And suddenly she's not mentioned in the book at all.
Oh, how interesting.
Yes. Yes. So at the age of 71, she decides that she's going to reopen the couture house. She had it all closed down for the war, but she's going to reopen it. So she has this event on February 5th because that's her day. And the Americans loved it. She had this beautiful staircase built in the building at 31. It was a spiral staircase, and she had mirrors put all along so you could see the fashions as they come all the way down the stairs. And she had herself a little hidey hole where she can sit at the top of the stairs and watch the show, just like our lady used to sit at the top of the stairs and watch the party. But the American press thought she was wonderful, and they loved it. It's gorgeous. Everything's fabulous. But the Parisian press hated it. They made fun of her age. They made fun of her simple designs. because this is, you know, the 40s and everything is, and the 50s and everything is very tight and corseted and stiff and starched again. So she says, all right, United States loves me. Off I go.
Okay, bye.
Yeah. So this is where we get the famous pink suit that Jackie Kennedy wore.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we get the story from Marilyn Monroe, where Life magazine asks her, what do you wear to bed? And she says, just a few drops of Chanel. The quote is, so I said, Marilyn said, when asked Marilyn, what do you wear to bed? Marilyn Monroe answered, so I said, I only wear Chanel number 5. And then they took her picture, spraying herself with the bottle, and that was
the one of the,
all it needed.
Yeah.
So she's huge in America again. People are using, you know, buying her suits and everything left and right. She remakes the handbag in 1955. In 1956, she brings tweed into her suit collection, and that's when she creates the two-tone black pump. This is the one with the black toe and back. So the tan back elongates the legs, and the black toe minimizes the size of your foot. And that was huge. In 1957, Neiman Marcus named her the most influential designer of the century.
I wouldn't disagree with that necessarily.
Which I think that she for sure. And in 1959, the packaging for number 5 was used in an exhibit in the MoMA.
I did see that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She died on January 10th in 1971 in her apartment in Hotel Ritz. She worked 6 days a week up until the day of her death. She didn't work on Sunday, and she died on a Sunday. But she'd gone to work on Saturday.
She shouldn't have quit working.
I know, right? She would sleep at the Ritz, but she spent all of her time at her apartments above 31. 31 still stands today. And the in June 2013, the French Ministry of Couture classified the apartment and the mirrored staircase as historical monuments. And recognizing their national importance. She never married. She once said, I never wanted to weigh more heavily on a man than a bird. Hundreds crowded her at the Church of Madeleine for her funeral. And a little more after than a decade after her death, Karl Lagerfeld.
Lagerfeld.
Yes, thank you. He took over the reins, and he is still in control today. In 1969.
Actually, I think he just
did. He
died.
Just retire? Oh, died.
Yeah.
Did he work up until the day of his death?
I don't know.
In 1969, her life story became a musical. Katharine Hepburn played her. There have been several biographies written about her. In 2008, there was a television movie with Shirley MacLaine. And in 2008, there was also a French actress that played her in her early years, which I want to see both of these movies. And there was something else that I was going to say, and now is just literally out of my head. Oh, her company is still privately owned. Guess who owns it?
I actually read who owns it, and now I can't remember.
It's the family of
yeah,
the perfume.
Because I remember reading that it was a family.
Yes, it's
Wiedermann's,
starts with a W. Yeah,
or
the family
Wiedermann's
that owns her perfume that she that had 70% of the profits now owns her entire company.
Because I did this circular thing into trying to find anyone associated with her that I could find a good story about. Like I looked at Karl Lagerfeld, I looked at that family, I looked at all these things, and they were all pretty clean. So.
And, of course, we don't know the details, but it just is interesting to me that they struck a deal where they took 70% of her company, or of her perfume, and now they own the entire company.
Yeah, that's...
And then I wish there was more interesting thing, or more about the Nazi stuff, because that's a crime.
I know, and I couldn't find a lot about that. The Model Hut thing I looked at, and then there was, another woman who was also a spy that she was associated with.
Uh-huh.
I tried to find, stories about her, but I just couldn't.
Yeah.
There's just not enough.
So, she was fascinating. She, made the best of a bad situation given her childhood. And then she, always survived. So you could say that the Nazi thing was just her always surviving instinct. But I can't decide if I like her or not because of that.
The thing that rubbed me the wrong way was suing the family
because, in the middle of the war.
Yeah, because they were Jewish and wouldn't have a favorable, wouldn't be on equal playing field.
Right. But then you look at that, they took 70% of this young woman's company when she was just starting out.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to her suing them. It's just when she did.
Taking advantage of.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was only one of the times that she sued
only
them. She tried many times.
The other times I'm fine with.
Yeah. But at that time, it was not a good look. Well, hanging out with the Nazis was not a good look.
Yeah. Don't hang out with
Don't hang out with Nazis.
Don't drink this drink either.
No, my God.
Unless you're super in love with
suntan lotion. But you could just take the top off a bottle of Saint-Tropez and drink that.
That would be just as good.
It would taste
probably
just
not
the same.
Good for you, though.
Probably not good for you.
Not a doctor.
No, not an expert either.
Nope, just drunk.
Just drunk.
As always, you can contact us on Facebook at Crime and Time OTR.
On Instagram, we are Crime and Time OTR.
On Twitter, we're at Crime and Time OTR.
And our email is crimeandtimeotr@gmail.com. Email is where you will want to send us cocktail suggestions, things
topics,
you want to learn about. Yeah.
Or just say hi.
Or just say hi.
And we also have a new Patreon page. Yay. If you want to buy us a drink.
Buy us a drink.
So that is
patreon.com/crimeandtimeotr.
And we're going to be offering some perks for our patrons.
Absolutely. I'm excited. See you there.
Thank you for listening.